Now, this airplane, by the time you were flying it, it's over 20 years old, and I'm assuming it's getting a little tired. And you mentioned in your, by the way, Dick's got a book here. It's called Firefly, and he's going to be over here in the Warbird merchandise, and he'll be signing this book, and you better buy it, okay? You're going to drink more than this tonight, what this book's going to cost. And tomorrow morning, you're going to feel bad, but if you buy the book, you'll have the book. Okay, enough about the book. Okay, tell me a little bit about the mission as far as the forward air controller where you rescued the backseater.
Oh, okay. That talking about the Boxer 22 search and rescue operation. That was the largest search and rescue operation of the war up until that point. And we had an F-4 that got shot down early morning, actually mid-morning, I guess, about 8:30 or 9 o'clock in the morning, shot down on the Ho Chi Minh Trail, and it was in the worst place it could have been because there was so much ground fire that we had to overcome. And so the Sandys went out. The Sandys were on five-minute alert, just like we did in F-106s. And the alert schedule was the same type thing. So the Sandys rushed out to the airplane and launched and took off and went over about 60 miles east of the base is where the action was. And the first thing you got to do is you got to eliminate the threat of guns, because when you have guns that are firing at you, you can't bring a helicopter in to hover over a survivor and pick him up with guns shooting at him. So you got to get rid of the guns first. And so with the help of the forward air controllers, the Sandys, actually the Sandy low lead is the on-scene commander, and he comes in and he trolls low level trying to get the guns to shoot at him so they can find out where the guns are and try to knock them out. Now, the problem with it was they put the guns in the caves and the karst. The karst were limestone formations that came straight up out of the ground. And they'd have caves at the base of them, and that's where they put the gun. So you had to hit them pinpoint. And that was, as I understand, I was told that was the very first time that the laser-guided weapons had been used to knock out the opposition. So when they got the gun silenced, then you can bring the helicopter up the river. The survivors were on opposite sides of a river. And you bring the helicopter up the river at low altitude and hover above them and pick them up. Well, the problem with it was the tail rotor on the helicopter that was hovering above the survivor got caught in trees. The aircraft commander on the helicopter thought that he was getting ground fire, and because of that, he decided that he had to pull out. And as he pulled away, the survivor said, "Why did he leave?" He said, "I was 5 feet from the hoist. Why did he leave? I was 5 feet from him." And it just broke our heart because it was so close to getting the guy out of there, and we couldn't get him out. So we had to leave him overnight, and the next day it was more of the same. The problem with it was the first thing we heard in the morning from the survivor was that the front seater had been killed in the night. They didn't take prisoners in Laos at the time that I was flying over there. They just shot whoever they came across. And he said that after he got picked up, he said that what happened was the worst time was just towards dark when everybody had gone home. All the Sky Raiders had left and all the attack airplanes had gone. The worst time was just that it wasn't quite dark yet. They didn't have flashlights, but they still had a light illumination in the sky. And they came down to the river and they started looking for him. They found in his place where he had been holed up there, and he said that they shot their AK-47 into that area there. He said he had moved up the river about 50 yards, and he said if they turned around, they would have seen me. But he said that they just didn't see him, and so they left, and he survived the night. It was on the third day we finally got him picked up, and that was a cause for a great celebration on the base. There was hundreds and hundreds of missions that had been flown in support of rescuing this one guy, and he's still alive and lives in South Georgia. His name is Woody Bergeron. He was originally from New Orleans.
We've got a one I guess not a chapter, but it's just a little bit in the book here. It's on page 277. It's marked there, Dave. I'd like for him to read it for you, and it really encompasses what these warriors were all about. So, Dave, if you'll read that for us, I'd appreciate it.
This passage was written in response to the mother of one of the guys that I had just flown with was shot down. And he was, I had just talked to him and became friends with him, and I had flown with him the night before. And the night he was shot down, I was going to go out about 2 hours later. So I was in briefing when the word came into the command post that he had been shot down. By the way, in my squadron, at the time we were there, out of 20 pilots in the squadron, we lost 7 of our pilots. So it was not a good situation. But he was shot down, and he was in the same airplane I had been in the night before. Well, his mother didn't want to accept just that he wasn't going to come home, so she wrote a letter to the wing commander asking about information about what happened to her son, and this is why this passage was written in response to that. I was talking about, the letter made me realize why my mother was trying so hard not to cry that morning nearly a year ago at O'Hare International Airport when she and Dad and Emily saw me off. She had said, "Be careful, Dick." "I will, Mom, don't worry." I knew I was well trained, and I could only imagine the hazards that lay ahead. But now I knew about those hazards firsthand. And thanks to Rick's mother's letter, I could see a family side. The ones left at home a little more clearly, and that they had, and that may have been the more difficult to handle. I have had it said to me, "I don't know if I would have had the courage to do what you did, to face danger without flinching. You're lucky because you know you've got what it takes." Well, I never know how to reply to that because I don't know if I could do it again. All I know is I did it then, and I was one of the lucky ones who survived. That feeling of invincibility is essential to anyone who looks danger in the eye and keeps going. But the tragedies of Rick Chorlins and J.B. East and Clint Ward and Bob Moore and Dick Lytle and Jim Herrick and all my other friends who had been killed and the sadness of their families brought me back to the reality that we were playing for keeps and no one is invincible. What she had said in her letter, she said, "I want to have more information about what he was doing, who he was flying with, where he was, and what happened to him." And then she wrapped it up by saying, "A piece of paper is not much of an exchange for a son."
Dick, that's very moving, and that's why I wanted you to read that. Tell me, now I ask you the same question. Do you think we were effective over there?
I think that the military did the best they could possibly do given the circumstances, but the problem with it is, and I mentioned it in the book, is that we weren't fighting the war to win it. We were fighting the war to just kind of stay even and not let it get away from us, and I think that was the problem that we had at the time.
Would you do it again?
I'm not sure. I don't know. Like I said, I never know how to answer that because I don't know. I know I did it once, and I don't know if I could do it again.
I think once is enough.
Yeah, it sure was enough for me.